missing this.
When that didn't materialise, I think both Paulie and myself probably looked at each other and kind of thought, what next?
Then get this, the all-new OTB Sports app. Off the Ball, Ireland's premier sports channel, now has a new home, featuring the biggest names in Irish and world sports. Podcasts, interviews, news, commentary, analysis, plus almost 20 years of sporting archives. All free and ready when you are, at home or on the go. The new OTB Sports app. Download it now from the App Store and Google Play.
The OTB Podcast Network.
The Football Show on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. As obnoxiously passionate about soccer as Frank Lampard after the final whistle. Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.
I'm prepared to anything I can.
Well, do it then. Do it then.
What about your start to the game?
Ah, it wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Welcome along, Football Show. We will hear from Stephen Kenny, who had his press conference this afternoon, named his first Irish squad for the Bulgaria and Finland games. That is on the way. First, though, Damien Delaney is with us. Good evening.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
I'm very well. Did you hear the good news there? Storm France is on the way, fresh on the heels of Storm Ellen. The good times keep coming.
Just absolutely. I mean, it's gone beyond getting kicked when you're down now.
I know.
You know.
So we want to talk to you predominantly, I think, about the Champions League final. Bayern Munich 1, PSG 0. First half, I would put it to you, pretty good. Some quality on show, chances, finally poised. Second half, a bit stop-start, a bit meh. Yeah. Overall, the game was decent.
It was okay. It wasn't a fantastic game. It wasn't a game that we hoped for or the game that we needed, I suppose. I think we were all hoping for a rip-roaring contest and maybe a 4-3 or a 4-2 or something like that. We never quite transpired, but it was bubbling along nicely. Never really kicked into real gear. It never really opened up to a point where you thought, you know, it was enjoyable from a spectator's point of view. But look, Bayern have won it, and I suppose the best team probably have gone on and won the tournament this year.
The Neymar chance, and you would say that was more of a save from Neuer than a miss from Neymar. That was an important moment. Di Maria threw his right foot at one as well, and it was a bit of a chance. I mean, he could have done better. And then the Mbappe one will haunt them. If either of those three had gone in, we've got a very different game suddenly. And, you know, Thomas Tuchel might be sitting there on the way home and thinking, oh, you know, I mean, I couldn't name the three. If I had to name three players, chances would fall to, they'd be about the three.
Yeah, but look, they was kind of, they had pretty much just those three chances, you know, give or take. So Neuer's a fantastic goalkeeper. So even when you do breach the Bayern defence, you know, you still got to get past him. But look, Thomas Tuchel would probably be sitting, if one of those chances going, thinking it's the only way he's going to keep his job, because there's rumours now already that Allegri from Juventus is going to come in. And you'd be fairly sure that the PSG will move on in another direction, which is a shame really for him because he was so close. But I think really the story of the final has to be Hansi Flick. Doubt, you know, when you read about his story, where he came from, his background, his football coaching career, and how he came into the Bayern job, it's a great story. It really is, you know, to be a Lowe's assistant from 2006 and then the German FA for a couple of years in 2017 and then Bayern assistant manager. And then he takes over a Bayern team that I won't say is in free fall, but is, you know, there's some serious issues there and they're on the verge of self-destructing, I suppose. Seriously unhappy players. And the kind of the format of an assistant always taking over from a manager and changing things, you'd wonder what was going on behind the scenes between Hansi Flick and Niko Kovac. Was he secretly in meetings, not secretly, but behind closed doors saying, you need to change things, you need to do X, Y, and Z? Or did he keep his cards close to his chest because he knew he was potentially getting the job? And that's always a question that has always interested me when assistants take over and then they change the setup completely. They change training, they change meeting times, they change everything. No, I don't know if Hansi Flick did that, but I mean, look, he would have had some serious problems that he was, I won't say inherited, because you could say that he was part of those problems, but maybe Kovac was such a headstrong guy that he didn't listen to his staff. I'm pretty sure Hansi Flick has minuted meetings where he was telling Niko Kovac, listen, you need to change this, you need to do this, you need to be a bit less abrasive, I suppose, because that was the shout that he was very, very abrasive and very, very direct with the players, and a lot of the players lost interest in him very, very quickly. So you'd wonder, was he kind of pulling the rug from underneath him as the things were falling apart, because he knew he was going to get into the job? But anyway, all that aside, he came in and he picked him up, got Thomas Muller firing again, got a really well-organized, well-drilled team, and implemented some fantastic bits and pieces tactically for them in a very, very short space of time, and became one of the most, I suppose, feared or one of the more deadliest attacking teams Europe has seen for a very long, long time. Look at the amount of goals they scored.
So I'm picturing the scene now back in October, and Niko Kovac is turning to Hansi Flick and saying, do you think I should put Thomas Muller back in the scene? Flick is saying, no, he's finished. It's finished. Don't let anyone hear it. He's done.
Yeah. You want to hear the things he's been saying about you to me, Gaffer. Yeah. Like, he's absolutely probably either thrown him under the bus there or just said nothing. I don't know. But it's always a format that always interested me.
That says more about you. You're projecting.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because I've seen it, because it happens so often. I've seen it so much. And you always see the assistant come in and he's like, right, clean slate now. Mm. We're changing training. And all of a sudden, assistant managers change. They become different people or they try to be something they're not. And it's a weird dynamic. But whatever he's done, he's been absolutely brilliant. And he has been fantastic.
The regeneration of Muller in particular catches the eye, because he has been on the wane for more than just the Kovac era, and he's been kicked out of the German squad. Yeah. Not kicked out of the German squad, left out of the German squad. He's had, extraordinary career. It just looked like Father Time had caught up with him and he was on the decline and heading, very acceptably for the exit door. And then, whoom, I don't know what Flick has managed to do with him, but he's done something.
But you see, the interesting thing about that is, I think Hansi Flick was technical director of the German FA, or whatever the equivalent is that they have over there, when Muller and I think it was Boateng were left out, and I'm pretty sure he would have been part of that decision when those guys were kind of cut loose from the German national team. So to get the Bayern assistant coach job, to all intents and purposes, from the outside, you'd look in and you'd say, well, Muller has a problem with Flick because, maybe Muller holds him partly responsible for ending his German career. By the way, I'm speculating massively here. I don't know, but these are like scenarios that from the outside looking in, you would think, geez, that's interesting. But then he gets the job and all of a sudden Muller kicks into gear again, So maybe he wasn't part of that decision. Maybe it wasn't his responsibility. But all these questions, and all these the optics from where we're sitting, he managed to turn it all on its head and put together one of the most fearsome units in Europe in recent memory.
Muller aside, what has Flick done with the team tactically? Is there any great masterstroke here that he's managed to pull off, or is this more of a man management feat?
I think it's a man management feat, and I think when the interviews and the bits and pieces that I've read. I read a piece with Taliso, I think it was, where he was praising his man management skills and his ability to make you feel better about yourself and inspire your confidence. And he just said, just speaking to him, you feel more confident. And that's half the battle, because if players feel better and feel better for being around you, when you tell them something tactically, they're initially, or straight away, they're going to buy into it. They're going to want to do it for you. They're going to want to implement it. They're going to break their backsides trying to do that for you. So he seems a really personable guy. He seems very, very close to his players. He has a nice rapport with them, from what I see. He's not like Conte, where he's effing and blinding and swearing when a player makes a mistake and stuff like that. Or he looks like he genuinely has an affection for his players. And I think that is half the battle in modern day football.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? Because we're all looking for the secret sauce and the secret tactical masterstroke and the latest innovation in the game. And you forget what you've got a bunch of 20-year-olds in the main who just need a bit of love and a bit of reassurance and to feel happy in themselves and in their work. And that is underestimated, probably because it's a boring thing to talk about at length.
It is, but I think it's the most interesting thing, with the whole COVID thing and the setup we've got stuck with out in Portugal, and you know the A2 was unbelievable against Barcelona, and then kind of, you know, Lyon and PSG, and you know, you're kind of thinking maybe there is an underdog story here, or maybe something special is going to happen. But it kind of, I won't say the final fizzled out, but you know, it wasn't what I was hoping for. But it was a decent game. But I think ultimately UEFA will just be happy that the tournament's done and dusted now, and we can look forward to next year.
For UEFA, it's an unbelievable success. You know, they've had different countries pitching up here across Portugal and across Germany, or maybe more so in Lisbon and across Germany in the Europa League. But it's been extraordinary that it's gone so well logistically. So much could go wrong. So from their point of view, it's great. On the final, though, it struck me in the second half as it became increasingly stop-starty and cynical fouling when any team looked likely to launch any kind of dangerous attack was the go-to solution, particularly for Bayern, I would have said, but I wouldn't excuse PSG either. Can the referee do anything to try and nip that in the bud when that starts? I mean, does he not just have to start flashing yellows and it won't be fair on somebody, but you're going to get a second one because it's ruining the game?
Right, but I think a lot of them were, there was nothing horrific happened, you know, that would have said, oh, that definitely, a lot of half fouls, a lot of pulling back and falling down and wasting time. And
when he sees the pattern, does he just have to start going, you know what, in a normal game, that half foul there is nothing. But in this game, given that I've had five others on the bench, you're just going to get a yellow for this. Does he start interpreting what's going on? Does he have license to do that?
He does, but I think it's a slippery slope for a referee, because if it doesn't stop and it keeps going, you set a bar for yourself now.
Sending someone off and you're hoping that stops it.
Right, but then you could imbalance the game, and then you became the referee who was too finicky, what was that referee in it's a Spain Holland game where he just let everything go and it was a free for all in the World Cup final. It was the English referee. It was Howard Webb, wasn't it? Howard Webb, yeah. I mean, and he still talked about for that. I remember the De Jong challenge and stuff like that. So no referee wants to be remembered for sending a guy off for two kind of half fouls and stuff. So there was nothing bad happened, but I think we view that different to the way the Europeans would view that.
Damaged the flow of the game, though, didn't it?
It absolutely did, without question. But I think it's a difficult one for the referee, because if he starts sending people off and all of a sudden it's down to 10v10 and, you know, it could get worse. And it's not a road I want to go down. Ultimately, the players have a responsibility to be better there. Mm. You know, the referee, it's not really his job to dictate whether a game flows or not. He's the referee. He's just there to judge it. I know he can either interrupt it or encourage the flow with his decision-making, but ultimately, if the players are carrying on the way they were carrying on. But as I said, we view that differently to the way European teams do, because they've actually view that as part and parcel of the game. They see absolutely nothing wrong with it. And I think as the game was kind of getting deeper and deeper into the second half, more and more becoming at stake, and I think both teams started to realise that one goal is probably going to be enough to win this. And then when you realise that the margins are that fine, and both teams, especially PSG, were so desperate for it, that I think they got out of their rhythm or hurt PSG more, sorry, with that type of carry on, because they were the ones that looked I wouldn't say anxious, but they looked a bit more on edge than what Bayern did. Bayern, for me, looked in a little bit more control than what PSG did. PSG were a little bit more desperate, and that showed in their general play in the second half.
Do you have Bayern then as the best team in Europe? Or, for instance, I'm thinking primarily of Liverpool. Was there a degree that, you know, they're in a sweet spot, knockout football as such, that you don't have to play everyone and things have worked out beautifully for them and they've, you know, played some great stuff along the way and taken advantage? Are they, are they your favourites to win the Champions League next year?
I wouldn't say they're favourites to win it next year, no. I think that there's going to be some, I think Liverpool will come back strong next year. A couple of signings, I think they'll be thereabouts. And I think there's going to be a big rebuild at some powerhouses in Europe. I'm hoping that Barcelona can get their stuff sorted out. I'm hoping that Real Madrid can get their bits and pieces sorted out. But I would fully expect to see Bayern Munich in at least a semi-final stage next year. Because I know they have Leroy Sané coming in again next year. So that's already coming into a fantastic squad. And I suppose when you look, they have Kingsley Coman, Perisic and Gnabry and Leroy Sané as your four wingers. I presume Lewandowski will be the number nine again next year, and perhaps they're going to add even more players over the coming weeks. But look, I fully expect Bayern to be semi-final, final next year, but I fully expect to see some other teams in Europe come back stronger next year.
How did you think Neymar played?
Pretty poorly. pretty poorly, I think, would be the harsh way of putting it. But look, they're the games that he's going to be judged on. You know, you're the main man, you wanted this role, you asked for it, you got it, you got to a final, and you need to have more of an impact on the game. And I don't think that he did. And you can say that Bayern were great defensively, or Bayern snuffed him out, or whatever you want to say. He still, as the player that he sees himself and the player that he wants to be, he needs to figure out a way to get his team over the line that game, as he did in kind of the Atalanta game, and as he kind of did in the Leipzig game as well. But it was poor, and I think his floods of tears afterwards kind of showed how upset he was. And I think he was probably upset with himself as well as, you know, losing the game, because he knew he didn't have a great game.
He certainly lost his composure in the final 20 minutes. I mean, his touch seemed to desert him. He was still showing for balls. I mean, it's not like he threw in the towel, but a certain level of composure or concentration was gone. He was almost upset at the sense that this is over. It was like he knew.
Yeah.
I thought first half, though, he was bright, and, you know, if he scores that chance, needless to say, against Neuer, it's a massive swing. Now, ifs and buts, obviously, but I think L'Equipe gave him 2 or 3 out of 10. It seemed a bit harsh. Like, there is a degree of ganging Neymar, or comparing Neymar to expectations, as opposed to just the evidence of the 90 minutes.
But that's L'Equipe's thing, isn't it? Just to be overly harsh and get headlines just for putting in a 2. That's what they're kind of known for. But
I think
that, to my point earlier of PSG snatched at the game a little bit, I just feel that Neymar was the one in the last 20 minutes, even when they were 1-0 down, you want to see that little bit of composure from that little bit of control, that little bit of, I suppose, a look of his teammates look at him, and he has a way of him saying, don't worry, I've got this under control, I can do something here. You know, that level of confidence from him.
No, I do. He was playing like a guy who was 3-0 down.
Yeah, desperate. He was so desperate for it. He snapped at the result, and he just couldn't quite find the. But he's like that, though, isn't he? When you think of how emotional he's been over the years, every time we've seen him, he wears his heart on his sleeve. And I think he knew it was slipping away from him, and he didn't show that level of composure or that level of kind of leadership, I suppose, where he could just say, everyone, calm down, please. Let's just keep doing what we were doing insofar as our passing movements, and trust me, I will get us something out of this game. And that's what you would have expected from Messi, or we've seen Ronaldo so many times over the years when it was going against their team. Those guys always had that look about it, like, don't worry, I'll get us back in this game, don't worry.
Robert Lewandowski, I presume you've never played against him, have you?
No.
It's funny, sometimes I just was watching him. And, you know, sometimes in a game, you watch an individual for a couple of minutes and just see what they're up to. He never takes the easy option off the ball. Like, there were numerous times Bayern Munich were starting attacks, and it might have been very tempting and very nice for Lewandowski to drop deep and take a touch and, you know, pass a little easy ball outright to Gnabry or whoever's out in the wing and, you know, look involved and look nice. He never does it. So when an attack's starting, I was just watching him. He almost turns his back to the ball behind him and ploughs at the two centre-halves, like just runs at, almost drives, gives them a little nudge, like drives them back and kind of occupies them. And I just thought, this lad is an absolute bulldozer to play against for a centre-half.
He's massive as well, and I'm sure we've all seen the picture of him in those sleeveless tops on a training ground. I mean, he's absolutely stacked.
Yeah.
But look, the guy's a pure finisher. He's got that edge to him, hasn't he? He's got that real feel where you know you're never going to have an easy game against him physically. I remember the header he scored in the Leipzig game from a standing jump, where he just come off his man, standing jump, got up above everyone and managed to generate a fantastic header down into the bottom corner. He fits what they do brilliantly. You know, he occupies two centre-halves, he stays high up the pitch. Centre-backs will, as a centre-back, when you're playing against someone like that, you know, if you're playing against a centre-forward that you know you've got under control, you can kind of do your job and help somebody else do theirs. You know what I'm saying? You can understand that, I've got this guy under control. If something happens, I can get back there and do it, but I'm going to help out my left back, or I'm going to help out one of my midfield players. He's the type of centre-forward that you wouldn't do that with. You'd always be thinking, he's my guy, I need to make sure I'm on him, you know, for 90 minutes of the game here. And if my left back's having a tough time, I'm going to say, hey, listen, chief, I got my own problems in here, so you need to kind of figure your own stuff out. So that's what he does for that team. He occupies two centre-halves.
Yeah. He's very unfortunate the Ballon d'Or has been cancelled this year. I mean, he would pretty much be nailed on for this year. Yeah. So he was exceptional again. The Europa League, briefly, everybody was tipping Inter. I think you tipped Inter. I mean, how obvious do Sevilla, you know, how many times do you have to win this thing before you get the message? So they won well in the end, and Lopetegui, it's redemption for him. And it will be interesting to see if Sevilla can ever get their act together in the Champions League to any great extent. It's a weird dynamic they have going on.
It absolutely is. And I think that's probably the best thing about it. And I think that's probably one thing that we all overlooked, because I almost certainly, you know, thought the Inter would not just win, but win comfortably. But I suppose you can't kind of put logic to the emotional kind of attachment they have to this trophy, to how the players see it, how the city and the club view this trophy. They love it. And I think that's probably the bit that we all overlooked.
Yeah. There are reports Shane Duffy may be going to Celtic. I don't know if you see Rod Stewart's on Twitter holding up a placard saying, come on, Shane, you know it's the right thing to do. Would this be a good move for Duffy going to a club like Celtic? It's obviously a big stage and high pressure. You're playing probably against inferior strikers week in, week out. So I don't know, you know, you'd be a good man to ask. Are you sharper for playing at, for instance, a Crystal Palace against the best strikers in the world versus playing, you know, big stage, potentially a little bit of European football, but predominantly not, but big stage and waltzing through too many games? Like, it would strike me Shane Duffy will go through a lot of games in Scotland not having to do a whole lot, you know? So where do you stand on that?
I don't agree with what you say there, because I remember speaking to Joe Ledley, who was at Crystal Palace with me, and I had this very conversation with him. I said, Joe, did you ever get bored, like, of playing away at St Mirren? And he said to me, he said, while we might win that game 4-0, he said, you can't imagine the pressure we're under. And even though we know we're the better team, we are expected to win 4-0. And if we win 1-0, it's almost like, you know,
Inquisition.
Not quite that level, but, you know, fans are going, geez, we only won 1-0 against, you know, one of these lower teams. So he said it like, the pressure is different. He said, when you're playing down here, you're under pressure because it's the Premier League and whatnot. He said, up there, you're under pressure every minute you're on the pitch to just be in complete control, to be completely dominant of every game. And even if you win a game 2-0, but someone say like a St Mirren or Inverness had a 20-minute spell where they were in control of the game, that's the talking point after the game. So he said it's a totally different pressure. But just to go back to Shane Duffy, I think his game time is going to be limited at Brighton. I think the manager has kind of pretty much kind of demonstrated that he's not going to be his number one guy, and you know, Shane's going to be depending on injuries or a serious lack of form for someone to get in the team. So I think it's important that he plays football, and I'm pretty sure he would like to go to Celtic, you know, being that he's from the north, and it'd be a fantastic move for him, and to be, you know, that whole kind of side of it would be great. But also, he's getting to play football, and he's getting to play football at one of the biggest clubs in Europe, which Celtic are. So,
they're not though. Like, I mean, in terms of standard of football, they're not.
No, they're not. But I mean, it brings a different level of pressure.
Yeah,
playing for Celtic brings a different level of pressure, and I think that Shane will be full of confidence coming into the Ireland squad, because I'm sure that he would be part of winning teams most weeks, and he'd be winning leagues and competing at, hopefully, Champions League level. So I think it'd be a great move for him, and I'd be delighted for him if he got it.
Okay. I'm not going to check my Twitter timeline after saying that. Celtic fans are going to come at me. before you go, I'm going to talk to Nathan in a few moments and play some what Stephen Kenny was saying today. I don't know if you see, the Irish squad was named 23-man squad. The Bulgaria game is on Thursday week, Finland game Sunday. I mean, look, Obafemi is an omission, which has been talked about because of his tweet. Not the greatest idea in the world on his part. Beyond that, there doesn't seem to be any great controversy. Of the midfielders, I'm just curious in particular, if you're picking three from James McCarthy, Alan Brown, Conor Hourihan, Jason Malumbi, Robbie Brady, Jeff Hendrick, Harry Arter, what three do you suspect Kenny's looking at there?
Well, I think Stephen's already said, reading what I read today, that James McCarthy's best position is the middle of a three.
Yeah.
So you might say that he's nailed on for that role. And I would say the other two that will go with it will be Jeff and Conor Hourihan. Yeah.
Right.
Looking at it, I'd say that looks like the best balance. That looks like the best kind of setup reading from what he said publicly, but we won't know till the first game where he's really going with this. But I know the Obafemi one, people might say it's, you know, it's a disgrace because he's been playing. Well, he said it was a disgrace, actually.
Yeah. he literally said it's a disgrace.
Yeah, he actually said that. Like, but I know that, like, some people might think that it's not a great decision because he's playing in the Premier League. He scored 4 goals and 4 assists, I think, or something along those lines.
Yeah.
But Stephen, what I liked is gave a fantastic demonstration as to why he didn't put him in the squad, because he said at his club he plays in a two. I don't play with a two. And can he play wide of a three on the right or the left? He says he's a little bit not quite there yet, developmental-wise, that he's not quite up to that role. And I think he probably spoke to the Southampton manager and probably said the same thing. Mm-hmm. There's less responsibility when you're one of two up front. Glenn Whelan not being in it, is it a shock? Probably not, but I'd say it's a surprise, you know, that, but look, Stephen's obviously kind of going off in his own direction now, and he's kind of maybe severing ties with a lot of players that have been there for a long time, which, you know, it probably is the right decision. So maybe some people see it as a bit of a shock. Maybe it is, it isn't, but it's a talking point, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I think he's explained his decision, and I thought it was great and refreshing that he only named a 23-man squad.
Yeah, well, we'll have all next week to talk about that. In the meantime, Damien Delaney, as ever, thanks, Mel.
Thank you very much, John.
Damien Delaney there with Football. Oh, one quick thing. Don't forget, tomorrow morning, OTB Brief podcast is what I need to remind you about. You'll find a 5-minute roundup of the day's sports news. It'll set you up for the day. The OTB Brief brought to you in association with Now TV. You can watch Sky Sports on the Now TV Sky Sports Pass and BT Sport and Premier Sports on the Sports Extra Pass. We'll hear from Stephen Kenny in just a moment.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. As obnoxiously passionate about soccer as Frank Lampard after the final whistle. Gamble responsibly. See Dunlewy.net.
Welcome back. Stephen Kenny's first game is pretty much here at last. Goodness me, it has been a wait. Bulgaria and Finland in the Nations League. Bulgaria will be Thursday, 3rd of September. Finland then Sunday, 6th of September, back in Dublin. Stephen Kenny named his squad today, a 23-man squad. They will meet up this Sunday. They'll have 2 days training at Abbottstown, and then they will fly out on Tuesday afternoon with that Bulgarian game on the Thursday. Some would describe the squad as interesting, thinking emoji, crying laughing emoji, Nathan Murphy. We'll come to that in a moment. But give people the headline news from this squad then. Who's in?
Headline news, like, there's nothing shocking. There's maybe a couple of surprises. We're obviously going to be looking at how many of the 21s would come through. So you have Troy Parrott in there. You've got Adam Ida in there. Aaron Connolly was very much expected to be in there. And Jason Malumbi is in there as well. And Mark Travers was always going to be the backup goalkeeper. But aside from that, that's it from the 21s. So there's no place for Darryl Shea, no play for Jason Knight. And probably the controversy that has emerged is there's no place for Michael Obafemi from his tweet a little bit earlier on when the, as you say, the emojis were used and the word interesting was used, which was shortly after a tweet which was deleted, which said disgrace and a couple of emojis. So Michael Obafemi's understandably not happy. So that's probably going to be the big story over the next 24 hours regarding this squad. I don't think there's any major shocks. Glenn Whelan is gone. Glenn Whelan's 36. He's going to be 37 by the time Euro 2021 comes around. So it's not a hugely surprising development. But he's the only player who started that game, what is it, nearly 10 months ago now against Denmark, who misses out on this. Kieran Clark came off the bench that night. He's not involved, but he's had quite a few struggles with injury. Maybe the exclusion of Jack Byrne may raise a few eyebrows, but he's had a bit of a struggle with injury since the restart of the League of Ireland. Wasn't able to take a huge amount of action in training ahead of the restart. It maybe hasn't quite hit the heights where Stephen Kenny felt he couldn't leave him out. And some of those championship strikers, which Stephen Kenny touched on in his presser when he was asked about Michael Obafemi, the likes of Seanie Maguire, Scott Hogan in particular, maybe might have been expected to be in there, particularly when there are so many attacking players, more attacking players than defenders in this squad. Just 6 defenders named for the 2 games.
Mm. We'll start with some of what Stephen Kenny was saying this afternoon. Naturally, he was asked about Michael Obafemi's omission. Troy Parrott in the squad, as you said, Adam Ida in. He scored a brilliant goal, by the way. I don't know if you see it on Twitter in the last hour or so. Norwich in a pre-season game against Germany. Really brilliant finish from Adam Ida. So he's in the squad. No Michael Obafemi with his 4 goals in 25 appearances this season, including 3 in the Premier League. So here is Stephen Kenny.
Michael is is a good player, good talent also, you know. And I think I scored a couple of very good goals last year. So I think, it'll be interesting to see Michael with the under-21 team in the up-and-coming games.
Was it a situation where it was himself versus Troy Parrott versus Adam Eda? Was it a two from the three, basically?
No. It was a lot of players, some of the players that we've left out are really talented, are on standby, and a lot of players that we've left out, you know, and I think left some good strikers out, you know, and I think players that want to make their mark and players that have been playing in the championship regularly, like Shawnee McGuire and James Collins and Scott Hogan, you know, who all feel that they can contribute and have all made contributions and have a lot more to give as well. So that's the nature of it. It's a lot of tough decisions, and I think that's the nature of it.
Just on Parrott, I think this is your first time talking since he's got his loan move confirmed. How big is that from your perspective, and how hopeful are you that he can succeed in the championship this season?
Well, no one can be certain. I think, I think obviously he had the appendicitis that knocked him for six, and then he came back and trained really hard with Spurs, did really well, got himself fit. Millwall, pre-season's gone well for him so far. He looks in very good condition. And, he's someone with a lot to give, you feel, and a great temperament. And, he wasn't picked in the original squad, to be honest. David McGoldrick, obviously, with his foot injury, coming into the second squad. So, Troy has all the if you're replacing David, Troy has similar characteristics in that he's very good with his back to goal, drops into midfield, can take you into feet or into his body and bring other players into the game. And obviously, he's a very, very good finisher as well. So I think, Troy came in when David's foot injury prevented him being selected for the initial camp. So we said, we'd bring Troy in.
There are a lot of forward-looking players in this squad, Nathan. Callum Robinson's there, Callum O'Dowda, James McLean, Aaron Connolly, Adam Ida, Troy Parrott, Shane Long, and David McGoldrick will join the squad for the Finland game. He has a long-term foot injury they're trying to manage at the moment. So I don't think it's an especially big story that Michael Obafemi has been left out. In November, Ralph Hasselhoodl memorably talked about a lack of professionalism in Michael's life and that he was a young guy who must learn quickly. And then the season did develop reasonably well for Obafemi. The goal at Stamford Bridge in particular jumps to mind, and he got an equaliser at Old Trafford. But even as late as June, Hasselhoodl said of Obafemi, without workload as a striker, you've no chance to play, especially in our team, and that's something he has to learn, especially when he gets the chances to play two games in a week. It's always a problem. We have to pay attention to his physicality as he's had injuries, and we really have to take care of him. But that doesn't mean in the second game he can rest on the pitch. It's important he knows he has to invest a lot, because if he doesn't, it's not good. It's a relationship that's hard to get totally to grips with, Hasselhoodl and Obafemi, because he keeps giving him chances. And, 25 appearances is a decent amount, and yet publicly he's not always brimming with praise. The short version here probably is Obafemi's time should hopefully come. Don't take to Twitter. I know we're all young and do silly things.
No, maybe the tweets today back up a little bit of what Ralph Hasselhoodl was saying, that there are at times maybe questions over his attitude and making the right decisions for his career. It's important to remember that, yes, the stats in terms of starts, in terms of appearance this season, in terms of goals, are well ahead of, say, Adam Eda and Troy Parrott. But he hasn't set the world alight since the restart. He only started two matches since the restart, and he was taken off at halftime in both of them. Now, he is only 20, and you're right, his time should come. But also from Stephen Kenny's point of view, Kenny doesn't know him as well as he knows Eda and Parrott. So Kenny had 12 games with the 21s. Eda started 10 of them. He was involved in every single squad. He knows exactly what he's about. He knows about his hold-up play. He has very much bought into what Stephen Kenny is about as well, and he's got him goals for the 21. So although you can understand from Michael Obafemi's point of view, he's probably looking at Adam Eda thinking, well, he hasn't played in the Premier League as often as I have. Eda's only that one Premier League start when they were well beaten by Manchester United, already got some goals in the FA Cup. And Troy Parrott's never played in the Premier League. So therefore, why should they be ahead of him? But again, Parrott has been in with Stephen Kenny has shown certainly he can perform, but also how flexible he is. And that, I think, maybe is what has gone against Obafemi here as well. Kenny touched on that. He wants forwards, and nearly all of those forwards are very adaptable. They can play in different positions. They can play across the front three, and he's made it clear he's going to play a front three. So Obafemi's generally been playing alongside Danny Ings as part of a front two, doesn't see that. And on his appearances for the 21s, and he's been unfortunate as well in that he's had injuries and he's been in around the senior squad at times, so he hasn't had a chance to be with the 21s. And you could see he was probably frustrated the night of the scoreless draw against Italy, where he drops back to the 21s and he doesn't start and he gets 20 minutes at the end. Then the only game he did start under Kenny was the one match they were beaten at Iceland. So right now, maybe it's a case that his face doesn't fit, but he probably just needs to knuckle down at club level and at under 21 level and do enough to impress him.
Yeah, it wasn't in that clip, but elsewhere, Kenny did talk about the lone striker role, and it's not one that Obafemi has necessarily played all that often, as you've mentioned as well. And it was notable when he talked about Parrott, he mentioned his ability to come deep, back to goal, and in a David McGoldrick-esque way, bring others into play. It's probably a little clue for us as to what Stephen Kenny is specifically looking for in his striker, be it Parrott, or be it Adamida, or certainly with McGoldrick, who does it anyway, as someone who can play as a link man as well, back to goal, because that's where we struggle so often. That's where play breaks down, especially when a McGoldrick, or before him, a Wes, wasn't in the team. On the League of Ireland front, obviously no Jack Byrne. Stephen Kenny asked whether we can expect more players from the league under his reign.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'll pick whatever I think is right. You know, I think it's, that's, you know, I think Jack Byrne, I really rate him, actually. He's a terrific passer. He's really a joy to watch. And maybe it's something that he's definitely on standby, and, you know, he's one that could feature again, you know, for a short. I do think he's really, I really like Graham Bourke also as well, as a player that maybe would suit playing in the continents more than in the championship maybe at times. And he's a really, really creative player as well. And Michael Duffy, obviously, has the potential at times to really be a, you know, he's really quick and direct and scores a lot of goals and players like that. So there are players definitely who could have an influence, and more to emerge, you know, more to emerge, you would say that, you know.
You suspect he's very genuine there, Nathan. That's not just the token. Oh, yeah, no, we'll keep an eye on the League of Ireland. Like when he talks about Byrne and Burke there, he's been very, very sincere.
Well, he's probably keeping more of an eye on the League of Ireland than he even intended, because he can't go to games in England right now or for the foreseeable future. So he's at 2-3 League of Ireland matches per weekend. So he is seeing these players. And I think people were fooling themselves if they thought just because a manager coming from the League of Ireland got the Ireland job that they're going to pick 3-4 players. And particularly at this stage, so he has a 23-man squad. He hasn't gone the Martin O'Neill route of naming a 40-man squad. He spoke about the restrictions because of COVID as to how many players they can bring into the stadium. So he's not going to throw players in just for the sake of it in terms of training. It also, because of the timing of the match, could have had quite the impact on the League of Ireland if Jack Byrne was included, because Shamrock Rovers played Bohemians that weekend, and obviously that would have ruled him out of that game. So maybe all that got into it. Jack Byrne, probably just shy of the 23 right now. And he said, like, Burke, Byrne and Duffy are the three that come up time and time again in terms of who are closest. But I think, yeah, they're probably just a little bit off right now. It's going to be a really interesting couple of weeks, I think, because this is such an unusual scenario that he's facing into. You touched on them flying out on the Tuesday, getting two training sessions. You even look at the Seamus Coleman, Matt Doherty situation, which I'm sure people are going to be discussing again over the next week. Is it one or the other? Could possibly somehow they both play, even though when he talks about playing an attacking three, it's hard to see how they could both fit in. Seamus Coleman's back in pre-season almost a couple of weeks now with Everton. Wolves pre-season isn't starting till the week of the international fixtures. So Matt Doherty's on his holidays right now, understandably, because Wolves went deep into the Europa League. So his first pre-season training session is going to be that session with the Republic of Ireland. Now, obviously, he hasn't had much of a break. You'd expect he keeps the fitness going, even though I think he had a bit of a tight hamstring when he finished up with Wolves. So that figures into his thinking as well. All these players are coming back from a short pre-season at the end of that rushed sort of 6-7 week spell. So he needs to try and very quickly get them on the training pitch, figure out what his best 11 is, figure out what the system is, and I'm sure he's thought about that in depth, but somehow get that across to his players in the space of a couple of training sessions and probably a few Zoom calls over the last few weeks.
Yeah, it's not easy. We have to have a real degree of realism here. You know, this notion that we're going to see Ireland fully formed in that first game against Bulgaria, and, you know, that it will be any fair version of what Stephen Kenny is aiming towards is a big ask. And gee, I didn't realise that about Matt Doherty. That is tough, because Nuno, as I understand it, basically does not give them a day off at Wolves. They are in 7 days a week. They train incredibly hard. He keeps them at that, you know, whatever that top percentile of your fitness is, he keeps them on it all the time. So you suspect somebody like Doherty then will feel a bit of a drop off. We'll see how all that goes. On this being a pretty exciting time, that came up in the press conference today, and it was put to Kenny that, well, at least presumably he's happy that he's got Nations League games before the qualifier.
This is a great period for Irish football coming up, because we've got eight games in 3 months. And then, so we've got the Six Nations League games. We've got, hopefully, a Euro playoff against Slovakia, which is, you know, it's a very significant game. The idea is that we'd be in the playoff final. And we've got World Cup qualifiers as well in March. So it's you know, the potential to have a very, very high number of games this year if things went well for us. And it could be a year like no other, you know. And I think, and we've got to think like that, you know, and I think we've got to prepare like that, and we've got to be absolutely very focused on what we need to do. And we've got really good defenders, you know. I think we've got potentially a really creative, dynamic midfield, and we've got cutting edge forwards. So we've got to just make it a cohesive team. We've got to be a cohesive team, and so we're looking forward to the challenge of that, you know, and hopefully we can achieve that.
Slash everything I said, Nathan. Really good defenders, dynamic midfield, cutting edge forwards. My God, we're going all the way.
Yeah, and he has to take these games seriously as well, which he also touched upon, because, right, we don't need to go down the complications of the Nations League, but doing well in the Nations League has many knock-on consequences for the coming years.
Yeah.
But also, you'd expect, I'd imagine, against Bulgaria, he's going to go with as close as possible to the team that will play in Slovakia. Two games is what he has to bed in his system. So he needs to get that across on the pitch in actual competitive game time. And also, if there are players from the 21s, inexperienced players, who are going to come in and potentially play in that game against Slovakia, they need to start these games. You can't just hold off and say, well, maybe by next year, by the time the tournament comes around, they'll be ready. You get the sense, particularly, I think, with someone like Jason Malumbi, who you'd have to feel has a real strong chance of starting in Slovakia. He probably needs to play these two games in that system, which would be quite similar, I'd imagine, to what he was doing with the 21s with a three in midfield. He needs to start these two games and then be ready for probably the biggest game of his career in a month's time. So that's a real difficulty, and it's a lot he's going to be putting on the players, and it's a lot he's going to be putting on himself. So every minute he has with these players is going to be huge in terms of what he can get across. And we've heard time and time again of the magic of Stephen Kenny, and you ask his former players, what is it? And they struggle to explain, but there's something about him that he gets across that confidence to go and express yourself on the pitch. And you even hear it there, the way he talks about, you know, there's nothing negative. There was nothing negative today in that press conference about what we couldn't do. Everything is what could possibly happen. Their words, they're potentially meaningless, but I think they're what people want to hear right now.
Yeah, Malumbi was on the show recently. I mean, he's made a huge impact at Millwall, and Millwall supporters definitely wanted to keep him on loan as long as possible. So you mentioned we're probably looking at a midfield three. James McCarthy, he was effusive about today, Stephen Kenny. James McCarthy of Crystal Palace. We have Harry Arter back in the squad. Jeff Hendrick now of Newcastle. We have Alan Brown, who a lot of people, for obvious reasons, are a big fan of. Conor Cowarhan as well has been very good this season. There's Malumbi. And there's Robbie Brady, who we don't talk about all that much. What's our midfield three there, I wonder?
Yeah, I've been thinking about the 11, and like, I think the defence, if that is the case with Doherty, probably picks itself, where you'll have Randolph in goal, Coleman, Egan, Duffy and Stevens. The midfield three, I wouldn't be surprised if it was McCarthy at the base and then Hendrick and Malumbi either side. So for the 21s, Connor Coventry played at the base. McCarthy probably isn't our traditional midfielder at the base, because we always think of him more Glenn Whelan, get across, do the covering job. But I think McCarthy can do that, but he also suddenly changes the dynamic completely, because your player in that position is looking to play the ball. He's looking to play it along the ground. And then he'll expect an awful lot from the two wingers, who are the two either side of, presuming he's back, I'd imagine it'll be David McGoldrick for that home game against Finland and probably for Slovakia, that they need to provide a huge amount of energy. He's brought Harry Arthur in again because he's somebody who gets around the pitch. Like, Malumbi is all action, absolute all action. It's probably the personality you want in there as well, because it's the one criticism we have of both Hendrick and McCarthy. There's at times a lack of leadership. They haven't kicked on the way we would want. McCarthy obviously curtailed considerably by injuries, but neither of them are the loudest, most talkative players on the pitch. That's not Malumbi. Everything you see from Malumbi, captain of the 21s under Kenny, is that he's not shy in coming forward, is that he puts himself about, is that he provides that little bit of a spark in there. So maybe it's Malumbi or Howerhan for that third position in the middle of midfield, but I wouldn't be at all surprised if he decided actually Malumbi, maybe that a little bit more physical than Howerhan if you give him the nod. And then I think if you give him the nod against Bulgaria, you have to stick with him. You play him against Finland, provided he's fit, and then you go into that Slovakia game with him as part of the team.
Yeah, there definitely is something in Malumbi that Kenny likes. I mean, he brought him into the Ireland squad when he was freshly back from injury, and Tim Malumbi's absolute shock not just told him he was playing, but made him captain, and he flourished. So he has seen something there. On the balance of the squad, then, I have two last very quick clips from Stephen Kenny's press conference today. Six defenders in the squad, eight forwards. He was asked about the general balance in the squad.
Yeah, like the adaptability of players, I think that suits. It suits, you know, I think, the way I want to play, like we want to play with three attacking players all the time. And I think, it suits what we have. You know, I don't see an issue. I don't see a lack of depth in that, unless you had two injuries at centre back in the same match. You know, I think maybe then that, you know, that. But we have players who can, you know, that would be quite unusual.
And then the final one, Nathan, Troy Parrott, Adam Ida, Jason Malumbi. We've been talking about them all kind of up relatively recently from under 21s into the squad. So Kenny was asked a bit more about those three.
Yeah, I think we've some players that have come back after being not involved in the last campaign, you know, quite a few players. But you're right, there's four players have come from the under 21s. Aaron Connolly, Adam Ida, Troy Parrott and Jason Malumbi. And I suppose they covered the country really between Galway, Waterford, Cork and the north inner city of Dublin. And I think, they've come through the various clubs, through the great school by clubs in the country and emerged and come through the Irish international teams at all the levels. And now they're in the senior international squad, which represents great progress, you know. And I think Jason Malumbi played for Millwall this season on loan from Brighton, very competitive. Really got an all-round game. He's very quick around the park, very, very competitive, great range of passing, and can dribble. So he's an awful lot. You know, he has sort of all the attributes needs to be a midfield player. And I think he's shown come back from a serious injury at such a young age, showing a lot of quality. So he's been captain of the under 21 national team. Adam Ida is, you know, our most prolific goal scorer at underage level for Ireland. He scored a lot of goals at all the levels. Again, very young, 2001, Bertie Saloni, under 19. And his, went from Cork to Norwich, and obviously he's finding his way there at the moment. And so he has a lot of potential, and again, a lot of attributes, and he's quick and good movement. And holds the ball up well, and has a good all-round number nine as a number.
There we are. So that's the gist of Stephen Kenny this afternoon. I notice New Balance and all the hoardings behind him there. New Era is the big tagline, which is written about 50 times on that wall, which is definitely trying to capture the general mood. That probably strengthens the case for Malumbi and the points you were making there. I mean, Kenny kind of said he ticks pretty much every box he wants a midfielder to take, and he was the first name he talked about there, so he's definitely front of mind. Overall, you know what? There's a lot of decent technicians in that squad, and you'd be very hopeful that Kenny is looking at that, saying we can mould something here, we can keep the ball for passages of play and create. So at last we're going to find out and have an actual game to talk about. It feels like we've been looking forward to Stephen Kenny's first game for, well, it literally has been
It has been, yeah. And it's a good game is the other thing. We'll talk a lot more about it. Like, we saw Bulgaria and Dublin last year for the friendly. They're a bang average team.
Yeah.
So I know it's away from home.
No great shakes, Nathan, I would say.
No, absolutely not. I don't think they've included their 38-year-old goalkeeper who made his debut at the Aviva last year, importantly, in their squad.
Sorry, was this the game where Stewie made a joke?
Yeah. For many people, still the most memorable thing about the game.
So the night of Stewie's joke and Jack Byrne's debut that game.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yes. They're rubbish.
We'll never forget it.
Yeah. So Bulgaria's 3rd of September, that's a Thursday, and then Finland the Sunday 6th. On in the Aviva, I presume, the Finland game.
It is, yeah. Empty Aviva Stadium. Yeah. No fans in at all.
Okay. Strange times. Nathan Murphy, nicely done. Thank you.
Cheers, Joe.
The OTB Podcast Network.